We have named this conference Shaping a Changing World. Quite ambitious, one could say. But isn't it exactly the spirit of ambition that is necessary to truly make an impact? When Senator Fulbright founded the Fulbright Program in 1946, he was a visionary. He wanted the program to be a means of waging peace through mutual understanding, 1 year after the end of the Second World War. Now, while the end of the war certainly marks a huge change, the world compared to today's world was relatively simple, or let me rather say ordered. During the Cold War era that was to follow, the world was practically divided into two blocks, and this situation persisted until the fall of the Iron Curtain in 1989. Shortly before this event, which marked the end of the Cold War, the German Fulbright Alumni Association was founded. Of course, I wouldn't go as far as to say that we had anything to do with that. Credit goes only to David Hasselhoff. But both events happened at a time that saw great change. And both events inspired us to choose our conference motto, Shaping a Changing World. When we started planning the conference more than a year ago, we deliberately decided not to focus on a specific topic. Instead, we wanted to cover a variety of developments in different fields that had occurred during the last 25 years. As the conference motto indicates, change itself is the topic of our conference. This may sound fuzzy to some people, and they are right. In a sense, this kind of fuzziness is indicative of the times that we live in. Compared to the relative order of the Cold War era, today's world has certainly become confusing, sometimes chaotic. As Fulbrighters, we understand that. We understand that order is and always has been an illusion. We understand that situations can be contradictory, even paradox. And we understand that in order to solve them, we must dare to think unthinkable thoughts, as Senator Fulbright said. This way of thinking, the Fulbright spirit, as it is often called, is what unites us all. And yet, we have all had our very personal Fulbright experiences. Some people may have met their spouses through Fulbright. Some people may have made friends for life. I personally discovered my huge interest in intercultural and transatlantic relations, and now I'm writing my PhD thesis about that field. The Fulbright program has fundamentally influenced and even changed all of us. While we should be thankful for this, it also entrusts us with great responsibility. As Fulbrighters, we are cultural ambassadors, not only of our respective countries, but also of the intercultural mindset, that is, of the Fulbright spirit. This brings me back to today's conference. As you can see in the schedule, we'll be discussing a variety of topics with experts from different fields, some of whom are Fulbrighters themselves. These experts will provide us with their individual perspectives, and they will help us understand the relevant developments in their respective fields. All of these developments bring about challenges, and all of these challenges require solutions. As Fulbrighters, we know that these solutions can never be all too simple. And because we know that, it is our obligation to get involved, to become active, and to shape a changing world. And that is what this conference is all about. Thank you.
Thank you, Benjamin. Good morning, everyone. We appreciate you coming out this morning. You can look outside and see how good the weather is. And for those of you who live in Berlin, you know this is one of those rare, perfect Saturdays. And we really appreciate you taking the time to come inside and take part in the conference today. I think what you're going to hear today will be just as valuable and rewarding and enlightening as the sunshine outside that you're missing right now. So it's okay to feel bad for a few minutes. We're going to make you feel better in a few minutes. Recently, I was telling someone that we were going to have Mr. Vogt and Mr. Kornblum on a panel discussion today, and someone said, well, you know, if they were going to make a Mount Rushmore of German-American relations, the faces of Kornblum and Vogt would have to be up there. But they didn't say what the other two faces would be. We're still trying to figure out which ones those would be. It's a real honor to have both of these gentlemen up here with us today. The program says we want to talk about the past 25 years in transatlantic relations. We're going to do that. I have a feeling that we're going to talk a lot today as well about what has happened in probably the last 7 to 10 days of transatlantic relations, and these men are specialists in that field as well. I think you probably all know these gentlemen. I'll start with Mr. Vogt. He is best known in transatlantic circles as being the point man for the German government in the last decade when you were talking about German-American relations. He was in charge of fostering and nurturing German-American relations and made a very good name for himself, not only here in Berlin, but also in Washington, D.C. And Ambassador Kornblum is a man who also made a name for himself in diplomatic circles around the world. Many of you may or may not know he is also partly responsible for the quote that President Reagan used in front of the Brandenburg Gate in the 1980s when he asked Mr. Gorbachev to tear down that wall. He was responsible for authoring that, if that's correct, Mr. Kornblum. And he is has remained a light in transatlantic relations, and we're lucky to have him here in Berlin. Both of these gentlemen are here with us today to give their impressions about what has happened in transatlantic relations for the last 25 years. They're both going to speak for a couple of minutes, and then we're going to start a conversation. And we'd like for this to be as informal as possible, so if there are questions you'd like to pose, please raise your hand. Feel like you're in your Wohnzimmer with sunshine on the outside, and we'll take your questions and go from there. And we're going to start with Mr. Vogt. Mr. Vogt, the floor is yours.
All right, well, I just wanted to say a very short first thank you. I've worked with Fulbright myself for more than 25 years, so I'm very pleased to be here, and I'm very pleased to see the Alumni Association is succeeding. But I also did, by the reason I wanted to say, some would say, I don't think we're going to talk about the last 25 years of German-American relations. We should talk about the next 25 years, which is much more interesting. And we're in an era now where there is one single principle, and that principle is change. Everything is changing. And it is changing primarily because of the great power which was released after the end of the Cold War, which had been had a cover over it for a long time, but also because of the information revolution, which has just changed the entire use, access to, and role of information. We're in a phase compared to the first printing by Gutenberg or the invention of the telegraph and a steam engine in the 19th century. And if you remember, each of those phases ended up with major upheavals and unfortunately major wars. So we should be not just joyous about what's happening, we should be careful about what's happening. But for you, who have lived in both kinds of cultures and are, as Mr. Becker said, cultural ambassadors yourselves, it's very interesting to understand how important it is to try and talk across cultural lines here, because as this change starts to happen, it's going to be often very confusing. If you look at the situation in the United States right now, our entire political life is turned on end. If you look at Germany, who has the most successful economy, at least in the Western world, if not in the world, what's the story? Politicians are under pressure. People are unhappy. There's no reason in the world to be unhappy in this country, especially on this Saturday. But the fact is, the voters are unhappy, and that shows you why, because there's so much change and there's so much uncertainty. So I think that's the point that I like to make, and maybe we can talk more about that. The last 25 years were, let's just say, very successful. That's enough to say.
Mr. Mayor.
The Germans perceived the American-German relationship after 45 as a relationship inside the regional European North American context. It definitely is now a relationship in a global context. And the conflicts we have had, or different perceptions we have had in the last days on Libya and on the Obama issue, Osama bin Laden issue, I quoted Angela Merkel, is typical for that. By the way, the Iraq issue as well. And I think that many Germans have problems to grasp this relationship in its global context. And secondly, I think that where we have to be aware is that normally strategic decisions are not taken by politicians when they take them with the mindset that they already know that they take strategic decisions. Normally, very often, they take a tactical decision or an ad hoc decision. And then from that ad hoc decisions, you have a strategic line being confirmed or being changed. And therefore, the decisions which were made in the last years and in the last days, on the German or on the American side, but I view naturally concentrate my views more on the German side, should be analyzed whether these decisions or statements symbolize a new strategic orientation of Germany in the transatlantic context, or whether unintended, they might have consequences of a strategic nature. This is the question mark which I have. And the second point is, I don't take the transatlantic relationship as a given. It is something which has to be renewed under changing circumstances. And those politicians who simply think it's an element of continuity, and we have to treat it like an element of continuity by praising all the forefathers, will unravel this relationship. You need to modernize it to maintain it. And that's the second point which I want to make, and it's very much related to the first point which I made as well.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Vogt. What do you think, Mr. Kornblum? Is the transatlantic relationship not a given as we start the next 25 years?
Well, it's a given in the sense that it will always be there. The transatlantic relationship began sometime in the 17th century, and it was always there. It had the ups and downs. Every once in a while, I was asked, isn't today, whatever it was, the worst crisis you've ever seen in transatlantic relations? And I say, no, I think World War II was really bad. And that was a crisis in transatlantic relations also. And so it will always be there. The fact is, we now have two transatlantic relationships, or maybe three. We have the human one, all of us, who know that we live in this transatlantic and increasingly global world. We have the political world, which is fighting to somehow maintain some kind of equilibrium within all this change. And thirdly, we have a world which is invisible to most of us, which is becoming more and more relevant every day, and that is the world of the globalized corporations and the globalized networks. This group lives in a 24/7, as we say in America, world. There is no night and day. There are no borders. A company such as Nokia, such as Siemens, such as Volkswagen, such as IBM, you can name 500 of them. They have an internal culture which is networked around the world. And one of the leading countries in this networked world is Germany. Germany has, for example, every single major logistics company in the world, which is the ones who are keeping this world going, are German. And so there is a German Atlantic relationship, which is virtually totally separated from the political relationship. And I see that as a big problem. The political leadership barely knows that this world exists. And so then you have situations such as the debate inside the EU over Libya, or this debate over what one should have done with bin Laden. But for what's going on behind the scenes, this world is of very little importance. And I think if we don't start having more contact between the actual functioning globalized world, some high percentage, Carsten ought to know this figure off the top of his head, for example, of transatlantic trade, which is something like 3 billion euros a day of transatlantic trade, some high figure, 60-something percent, is so-called intercompany trade. It's just transatlantic companies trading with themselves. And that shows you, every time I talk to somebody from Siemens, they give me a different number as to how many employees they have in the United States. It was 60,000 and it was 70,000. I don't know what it is now, but it's probably nearing 100,000. In other words, these people live in a globalized culture. And they live beside political authorities, but they do not live integrated with political authorities. And I personally think that's probably the biggest challenge of the world coming up, is to make sure that these two worlds somehow understand each other better. So transatlantic relations are not only going to live, they're getting deeper, and they're getting more successful all the time, regardless of the efforts of the political world to make them less so.
What do you think, Mr. Vogt? Because I think the perception here in Germany is that the business world in Germany is very well connected with the political world here in Berlin, and that there's not this disconnect that Mr. Kornblum is talking about, particularly in Washington.
It's the two worlds are connected, but they don't understand one another.
Yeah, sure. Connected they are. They just don't have
any
dialogue.
And they tick in a very different way. And while for the business world, the global role of Germany or Germany's role in a global world is a given, it's not a given in the political field, and especially it's not understood by German citizens on the political side. What I mean by that is Germany, which always, after World War II, tried to be small, and by trying to be small, increased its role inside Europe. By being soft, we increased our power and influence. It's now crossing boundaries, which means that Germany is, if Germany is not acting, Europe is not moving. And we have not only responsibility, but power. And this means we have to learn how to deal with this power in a responsible way, not how to negate it, not to withdraw from politics. And the US is on the opposite side, has limitations of power. So we approach the new world from different auspices, and therefore very often we misinterpret one another and we misunderstand one another.
Would you say Germany's vote on the UN Security Council resolution on Libya is an example of a big power in Europe unsure of what it should do?
I hope they were unsure. But if they were sure about what they were doing, it's even worse. And this is an example which might have been motivated by an ad hoc situation. And if Germany continues on that line, it will unravel its position not only in the transatlantic context, but also in the European context.
Do you think Angela Merkel regrets that decision?
I hope so. And I hope she takes time to think it through. And because it was a decision where Germany was voting against not only the United States, but also against the European partners, it voted against where a majority in the Security Council was in favor, unlike in Iraq. It voted against where it agreed on the analysis of the situation in Libya, unlike in Iraq. And it disagreed more or less in a situation where the issue was not very divisive inside Germany, where, for example, people like Heidi Wittschreck-Zoll, who was not a most prominent promoter of the Iraq war, was in favor of a military intervention. By the way, I was skeptical of a military intervention in Libya. But having said that, you could have voted in favor and on the other side maintained a certain skepticism about the implementation of such a military mission.
Mr. Kornblum, what would you say, looking at President Obama and his policy with Libya? Was he trying to be the non-Bush president? He was reluctant to get involved in Libya. Once the U.S. was involved, he was very quick to want to delegate power and responsibility to the Europeans.
Yeah, that's right. Well, first, don't forget, President Obama has two other engagements that are a big burden to him and to the country. So he didn't necessarily want to have a third And so I think it was simply good strategy on his part to let the others first take the lead and then to join them once he saw that there was a broad Western consensus in favor of it. But I think Carsten has put it very well. Germany is now trying to figure out how to deal with its growing power. The United States, and it's not just Obama, the United States has been trying, really since the late 1990s, to try and figure out how to limit its great power. And the two things often come into a clash. And I think that it's going to be very important in the coming years, especially for Europe, and particularly for Germany, to define very clearly to the United States why this European structure and this transatlantic structure is important. Because I have a feeling that, and it has, again, nothing to do with Obama or anything, it has to do with really long cyclical trends in the United States. I think after the big exertion of the Cold War and now with the Iraqi War, I think the United States is in a move simply to pull back from the world. Mm-hmm. And that is, Obama foreign policy is that. That's the basic thing it is, and it's the same thing as the Bush. You may think it's strange if I say the Bush foreign policy was to pull back from the world. But what both Obama and Bush have in common is they see the world not as a set of structures to manage. They see it as a collection of threats to defend against. And this long-term management, which was the keystone of American foreign policy from 1945, I would say through the Clinton administration, is now slowly wearing away. And if you talk to the younger generations of people who are in Washington, they don't even understand it. I can tell you because I talk to them. They don't even know what you're talking about. They figure Europe is solved. We got rid of the communists. Europe was reunified. Everybody's strong and rich. So we should just talk with each other like we talk with Canada or California or whatever. They're much more foreign than most of Europe is. This idea that the United States has to be part of a complex global management structure is wearing away in political Washington. At the same time, it's growing in economic, technological America. Go to General Electric headquarters. They see the world as a General Electric world. Mm-hmm. And both German and American industrial, big, big companies, have most of their employment now outside of their own borders. And so that's what I mean. We're coming into a world which we can't even define in the terms that all of us learned. We have to come up with new terms to define it. And that's going to be very difficult. And that's why a group such as yourselves is actually extremely important, because you understand more than most people do what the stakes are and can hopefully help in that definition.
Do we understand each other at all anymore? Mr. But you were talking about the difference in the way Germans or Europe reacted to the death of Osama bin Laden compared to the way the Americans acted.
I think these cultural differences were always there, but they matter more in the future than in the past, because many of the challenges which we face are not only military power, they are represented by cultural challenges, political cultural challenges. And therefore, it's not a debate about missiles, it's a debate about perceptions. And there always has been a stronger component in American policy to be in favor of punishment than in favor of atonement. There is always has been this difference. And this comes to the surface in this debate about the killing of Osama bin Laden. But there is a second component. This has always been there. But there's a second component which I also see in the German reaction, which is that we don't understand the emotional component of the American reaction after Osama bin Laden doesn't exist anymore. And this shows a certain detachment from that emotion, which was there in 9/11. I simply must remind the Germans that we killed a terrorist when we liberated in Mogadishu, German hostages. We had a controversial debate when Holger Mainz was killed, when the police tried to get him in our terrorist activities. There were a couple of terrorists killed, and there was always a controversial discussion whether this was needed, unavoidable or not. But and there is naturally, you can debate it whether this action against Osama bin Laden was a police action or a military action. In legal terms, you can debate it. In practice, you know it was a military action.
Based on a congressional authorization.
Yes, it was a military action. And I personally think I can say I would have preferred a police action. But to have such a controversial debate when Americans treat it like a military action. I understand a certain amount of controversy, but the number of journalists who asked me about how can the Americans do that shows to me that there is not only a difference in culture, there's a difference in understanding. And I think this is more serious than the specific reaction. It would be serious if it's a detachment of the emotion which exists on the other side of the Atlantic. We can have a controversial discussion, but this detachment and this misunderstanding of the American reaction and motivation, I think this is more, which yeah. I take more serious.
I agree with that. First, let's make it clear, there is no debate going on.
In the US.
The United States has barely taken notice of this fact. That's partially because we don't ever take notice of what goes on outside our country, but secondly, because we're all taken up in the great joy over this event. And so this is a debate among Germans about Germans. This has nothing to do with the United States. Secondly, I think that Carson's point is maybe the most important point which will be made here this morning, and that is what this debate, what this discussion inside Germany shows, and add to it the abstention at the UN, is that Germany is now, again, I'm just quoting Carson, he is being pushed into a role of influence and even power, a word which Germany hates to hear, but it's true. And it is amazingly ill-prepared for it. And the fact that a discussion like this can take place, that nobody stands up and says, look, what are the strategic implications? What does this mean? Is the United States now going to be a more self-confident leader? Does it mean that Obama is going to perhaps have an easier re-election case? Or does it matter? What does it mean for the Near Eastern democratic movements which are taking place? Is this a good thing for it or a bad thing? You don't see these questions in the German press at all. You see the question of, was it right to kill him? That suggests a truly dangerous fixation on the unimportant. And I think that that's the problem that Germany is going to have as it now tries to move into this role of influence, is forced to move into this role of influence, that the political leadership for 45 years has avoided all of these issues, and now they're coming to the fore. We could have a long discussion of the euro problem. It's the same thing. Germany thinks it's somehow being misused in the euro thing, which in fact is Germany is probably the biggest winner from the euro. So you have a situation where the country is now being pushed into a totally different role in the world and is really dangerously ill-prepared to manage it.
If I may, also the debate about Libya was very similar to that. You had a disaster situation in Libya, so we had the debate about morality, whether it's moral to do something or not to do something. But morality in terms of a strategic serious debate is not only about intentions, it's about consequences. There was not a serious debate of not how you start an intervention, but how you end it successfully and get out of it. And therefore, those who endorsed a military intervention there, which, by the way, happened on the left, on the right in the German scene. A lot of Greens did it as well. Should have also mentioned the consequences that this was in all likelihood mean a longer military commitment with an unclear outcome, with civilian victims as well. But to think that you can only target in a military conflict some nasty Gaddafi people, and then you go in, go out, is a naive assumption, and it seems to be moral, but it's totally unrealistic. And what I think that those people who were against the military intervention should have said, we prefer that Gaddafi takes over, a couple of thousand people are killed, but this is preferable to the situation of an intervention. By the way, we react in such a way in Syria. And those who were intervening should also have said that I'm willing to have a longer-term military commitment. It might risk a division of the country. We have afterwards to stay in the rebuilding of the state. And a sizable number of civilians will be killed as well. This is a strategic serious debate. But we had a debate about morality and non-morality of intervention. This is, you can do as Switzerland. This you cannot do as Germany in its position as we are now in.
But it sounds like, Mr. Vogt, you're defending the Germans' vote then at the Security Council.
No. I think that you can have, when you are very cynical, which I am naturally not, but if you are very cynical, you could have voted in favor and said, and we are very concerned about the implications of an intervention, but we don't want to block it. And we will do everything to help that this will be successful, but German military will not be involved.
So say yes and do nothing.
This is, by the way, what the French very often do and the British very often do. So it would be, we have good examples for
that. Well, besides that, it's also the basis upon which these organizations operate.
Yeah.
To give political support to a peacekeeping intervention, whatever kind, and the UN has 15 or 20 of them going all the time. To give political support to it doesn't mean that you are going to participate in it militarily. In fact, what the UN does, and also what NATO does, it's the same principle. Once a action has been approved, then the Secretary General goes around and figures out who can participate in it. And needless to say, the UN has 250 members, so not everybody participates. But if you take the intervention in Bosnia, for example, which I had a lot to do with, we ended up having 64 countries in the first group that went into Bosnia in 1995. And this was a great show of political solidarity. But one of those countries that did not go in first was Germany. Because Germany had just, in June of 1995, had just had the Constitutional Court decision. And Germany wasn't ready to go into Bosnia yet. And so it didn't go. We all said we understand that completely. What Germany did do was to have some back support troops in Croatia, which were valuable as a rear guard. But it took 2 years before Germany felt politically able to put troops in Bosnia. So there is no reason that somebody could not vote for an intervention and then say, I wouldn't even call it cynical. It's the way it is. Carsten could say, the German government could have said, we're just not in a position to do so right now. We're totally stretched in Afghanistan, which is true. Nobody would have said a word. That's the way these organizations operate.
Let me ask you, gentlemen, before we take some questions, what about the notion of the media in the United States compared to here in Europe? There are some critics who say in the United States, Americans, when they want information, only have sources that yell at them, shout at them, and give them strong opinions. And Europeans, Germans, receive more balanced information and more balanced news.
That's nonsense, of course. It's total nonsense.
Yeah, but where, Mr. Cormier, where are Germans being yelled at when it comes to television news?
No American needs to be yelled at either. They just don't have to watch Fox News.
But they do. But they do watch Fox News.
See, the difference is not that. There are some shows on German television. I've been members of them where I've gotten yelled at a lot. The difference is that in the United States right now, there's a market for such things. It's not that there's a difference in the media. It's that there's a market, and there's a market here for it, too. But the difference, the real story now is, of course, that you have, again, the media is like everything else. It's now totally global.
No, I think that is the major difference. And the major difference is when you look at all the German talk shows, you have in those talk shows always the presence of a nun and a prostitute. In the American talk shows, you have one channel for the prostitute and one for the nun.
That's right.
Meaning MSNBC and Fox News. Oh, yeah. And this means that many people whom I meet in the US are defined by the channels, by the channels which they look at.
All right.
When I meet a person who is quoting Fox News, I know he votes Republican. When he views MSNBC, he's a Democrat. And this is a serious problem, which I see that many Americans now live in terms of information. They have access to all the information, but they use the access which is partisan. And therefore, the perceptions of this is one element, by the way, in the U.S. reality, which leads to increasing partisanship in the public debate. It's much more partisan than in the German debate. And I think there the media play one element in this, one important component in this negative development in the American public debate.
Okay. All right. Now that we've talked about Fox News, any questions from anyone? Gentleman here in the front.
When the Iraq War began, all we seemed to hear about was how much the Americans hated the French and refused to drink French champagne. And we didn't hear much antipathy about Germany. Do you think this was because German-American relations were being handled better?
First of all, the French, once they said no, wanted to take the moral lead. And therefore, they were more exposed. We said no earlier and tougher, but the French took the lead. This is one element. The second component is, I think we did more to reestablish those relationships. And I was part of this process, and it was not easy. I mean, there were people who said to me that I was poor or prejudiced against democratization, and that people couldn't expect Germans to be in favor of democracy because they always had ambivalent sentiments about democracy and so on. So it was, in the White House, it was relatively tough. But I think we did more to reach out to the Americans than the French did. And I discussed it sometimes with French counterparts. And they said diplomacy is state to state. And when I talk that I go to Jewish groups, to religious people from the religious right, I met with neocons and all that. This is not how French diplomats deal with politics. And I think this is one element where the French diplomacy and the German diplomacy is different from one another. And I like nasty remarks. So first, on the statistic level, the United States has twice as many NGOs per capita than Germany has. France has about 50% of NGOs than Germany has. So in the US, we have a state which was invented by the society. In France, we have a state which is still looking for a society.
Mr. Vogt, just quickly, a question to you. Do you think, Mr. Kornblum, you can speak to this too. Do you think it's fair to say that Germans fetishize the notion of Americans, and Americans basically really don't take notice of Germans, that we think with cognitive crutches? In the media, for example, in the United States, when you think about Germany today, you think of the Germans as castrated Nazis. And when you think of the French, you think of the French as the Europeans who want to be a superpower. That's why it's so much easier for Americans to get upset with the French, because they're seen as a potential threat, but the Germans are just not on the radar screen for the Americans.
Just about everything you've said is not right.
Be a little bit more clearer about that.
We certainly don't see the Germans as castrated Nazis. There was a time up into the 1960s when there was some of that. But I was in the United States a lot during the very tense times of the Iraq War. And I found, and the relations between the governments weren't the best, shall we say. But I found virtually nobody who had anything bad to say about Germany. And I found lots of people who had very, very many good things to say about Germany. You have to realize that it just came out a couple of days ago, so it's very, very current. The BBC and other news organizations do public opinion polls about which is the most respected country in the world. And over the last 5 years, Germany has won every one of them as being the most respected country in the world. And if you go into the United States, into universities, as I do a lot, and into population, you find, when I say I live in Berlin, people are just envious of me for living in Berlin. This is an old view you have of German America. I'm sorry to say that, but it doesn't exist that way anymore. What is true is that the German press and politicians, of course, take much more notice of what goes on in the United States than American press takes of what's going on in Germany. But I've told my friends from the New York Times several times recently, I wish they would just stop writing articles about Berlin and how great it is, because other than that, we won't have any space to walk on the sidewalks anymore. Germany is at a very high level at the moment in the United States. And that's good, except, I agree with everything Carsten has said. It's good, but there isn't any modern political framework around it. That's our real problem. And the modern political framework, we've talked a lot about in Germany, of why it is dangerous, because Germany still feels in a way sort of pushed around by a big American power, when they should realize that what they are is probably the second most important member of the global network that the United States is the power of. And the United States, on the other hand, feels very threatened from the rest of the world and wishes that Germany would do more. But it's not that, the difference is that we are the world's power. And so everything we do, from what the rock stars are wearing today to what the car companies are doing to what the president does, everything we do is big news around the world. Everything Germany does is not big news around the world. But that doesn't mean that there isn't a relationship there. There's a very, very tight relationship. And I get asked now continuously, I mean really often, how are they doing it? Please tell me, what are the German secrets? How come they're doing so well economically and we're not? And so Germany, just to go back to our first point, Germany is now living in the actual state of being a very powerful, influential country with the mentality of a defeated country that doesn't want to somehow even be seen as being in the leadership category. That's the problem we have. It's a good problem to have, because it means we're moving forward. But as Carsten has put very well, there can also be dangers in it, because the danger of misperceptions is at the moment quite high.
It's an asymmetric relationship, because the U.S. is more important for us than we are for the U.S. But In asymmetric relationship, you have always a situation that the bigger partner says, ask himself, where is the smaller partner relevant for action?
That's right.
And the smaller partner always has to think about, how can I influence the big one? And this is an evergreen and will be an evergreen in German-American relationship. But what you mentioned, insofar as history is concerned, and I like irony, I said it earlier, It is ambivalent in its importance. And you can see it, and it's not structured only in one direction. You see it insofar as the relationship between Germans and American Jews are concerned. When you look at American universities, the number of people who, number of people who deal with German issues, you have a relatively high proportion of people with Jewish background. When you look to the visitors coming to Berlin, there is a relatively high percentage of American Jews. Those people who come to Germany come there for two reasons. One is the negative history, and the other is that Jews cannot define the history without Germany. Because of the Holocaust, but also because reform and conservative was developed in Germany. Therefore, I think that even when you deal with American Jews, it's no longer only negative. I always saw this group as an asset for German-American relationship. And therefore, I disagree with you. I think you can change something. A negative experience can be used for positive elements. And this is what we should do more, and this I saw always as my task, and therefore I don't see it only with this negative context. Okay.
Questions? In the back there.
One short question relating to the previous discussion we had on the role of Germany in the world, and especially with regard to the transatlantic relations. If you look back the last couple of years, even at the position Gerhard Schröder took on the Iraq war, he was like telling the public, this is the German way. And I think that in the last couple of years, we can see that Germany is more becoming self-confident and proposing its solution as a world solution. Like if you look at the financial crisis, Germany took the consequence to forbid short selling. If you look at the energy sector, Germany is moving ahead with nuclear policy. If you look at things like international inventions, Germany becomes more and more looking inward, not seeing its role worldwide. So I got the impression that with the economic power that has been proven during the crisis and now in the recovery, Germany doesn't see itself anymore as just a supporter of international positions, but building its own position and then giving this as an example for other countries to follow. You can also see that with the euro crisis, like the budget policy in Germany that has been enforced should now be the example for all other European countries. So the question that comes to me is, do you also see the same development happening, and do you see it a positive thing or rather not? Thanks.
Self-confidence would be good. Arrogance would be bad. And where I see a negative component, where Germans who always think that the Americans are missionary, where Germans are too missionary themselves. I give you two examples. One is, it's my own experience, when I listen to Germans talking with Israelis, teaching them how, by talking to neighbors and being nice, one could solve the problem. And surprise, surprise, the Israelis have learned something different from their history than to be nice. The second point is on environmental issues. On environmental issues, Germans are very missionary. There, the Germans on the good side and the Americans on the side of the evil. And the Germans are as missionary, I think for good reasons, but they're as missionary as we normally think Americans are. On these two items, peace and environment, Germany are global. They have the global solutions. They have the global answers. And their policy is very, very missionary. And interesting enough, Germans don't see it that way.
Neither do Americans.
And neither do Americans. And therefore, when you deal with transatlantic issues, the task which you always have to explain your country to your countrymen how it is viewed from outside and not how it's viewed from inside. And the same applies to US citizens. And in the present economic crisis, Germans who think they suffer from the Greek, and they are too soft, they think, in that context. When you live in Greece, we are seen as being tough. And we are seen as a country which is occupying the economic system by redefining it and saying, either you do that and change your economic culture, or you don't get anything and end in a catastrophe. So this image of us in Europe is like, very often in the southern part of Europe now, and Germany must be very careful about that, sometimes it's like the image of the United States in Latin America.
I'll make three quick points. First, the United States was settled by deeply convinced, one might even say radical, Protestants. And the common thread between German and American society, with all the differences, has been this Protestant sense of self-righteousness. Martin Luther is our common patron saint. And this is not going to change. America is now becoming less Protestant because of immigration, but the seeds were sown. and it's not going to change. And so Americans and Germans are very, very similar in this fashion and in one other fashion. And that is, again, despite all the differences of history, both of the modern cultures, the modern German state and the modern American state, are products of the Industrial Revolution. Germany before 1800 was a totally different country than it was after 1800. And America before 1800 hardly existed. So we were both created by the Industrial Revolution, which means that we both have a sense of destiny, which continues, even though the German sense got, shall we say, sidetracked for a while, it's back. And we both have a sense of identifying ourselves according to achievements rather than through French cultural history or whatever. And so that means that there are more reasons to be different because we're so similar in foundation, there are more reasons to have debates. That's point one. Point two is that as this process continues and as this Protestantism continues, Germany is going to be, shall we say, it's going to lose its cover in the EU. Germany, Carson said it, was brilliant in being self-centered, determined, and successful and making everybody think that it was the most selfless country in the world. This is, someday somebody in this country will be smart, have enough courage to write a book about that. But so far, historians have shied away from it. But I actually wrote an article about it a year ago in the Herald Tribune, in which I pointed out that almost every single major development in the EU and in NATO was pushed and desired by Germany, only they never let anybody believe that it was their policy. So this idea of Germany getting its way is, you know, they used to say, you got to do it for us because otherwise we'll be bad again. You know, that used to be one of the ways they do it. But so the idea that Germany is all of a sudden defining its interests is just not right. How many people did Helmut Kohl consult with before he issued the 10 points on German reunification? One. Yeah. Horst Telchek. That's all. Not even Hans-Dietrich Genscher.
No.
So this is not new. And so thirdly, come back to what we said, and Carson said it, because of these factors, United States and Germany have to somehow find themselves a different kind of dialogue. And that's the real story. And it's not happening at the moment. It's not a disaster at the moment because everything is more or less on a friendly plane. But we're not going to move forward, and especially we're not going to move forward in meeting the real challenges, which are those of the non-Western world, which are coming down upon us. We're not going to meet those challenges unless we have a different kind of dialogue. And in my view, one of the most important factors of this new dialogue is going to have to be a more self-confident but practical, not ideological, but practical European approach to the United States. The trouble, and I can tell you, I did this for 30 years, the trouble that you have when Europeans come to us, and especially Germans, and be self-confident, it's always ideological. It's never practical. Carson mentioned in the environment, the Kyoto Agreement was treated with the United States not as a practical issue, but as an ideological issue. And I could give you chapter and verse on that. And so Europeans are going to have to learn a new sense of pragmatism with the United States. And that's going to be hard. The United States, for its part, is going to have to learn that just because the Cold War is over doesn't mean it doesn't have to play a management role. So those two things require a much different kind of dialogue than we've had in the past.
Okay, I think we've got time. It's 10:30. We've got time for one more question, and then we're going to have to wrap it up.
You mentioned earlier as the upcoming change that you see in the world. You mentioned the importance of multinationals and the multicentricity of the coming world. The question is, which bodies do you see that develop this change, and which ideas do you think are the most intriguing or most relevant to this debate?
Which bodies? You mean which international organizations? Well, I think the international organizations are going to stay. They're going to each have a role, but they're no longer going to be the determining factor. There are so many new things we have to get used to. One of them is to realize that what took place after 1945 was not the invention of a new world as we thought it was. I grew up, I was taught this, and I have said it more often than I can tell you. It was not the invention of a new world. It was a strictly organized, almost authoritarian program put forward by the Western democracies to try to make sure that World War I and II didn't happen again. And it was brilliantly successful. But after 1990, that kind of strictly organized world is no longer relevant. And what's going to happen now is this globalization is in fact going to be multicentric. It's going to be networked. And what we need for this is not an organization. We need to make sure that there is a democratic operating system for this world. And we have very great advantages because this whole world right now is based on Western principles, Western technology, Western geography, everything. But it is also rapidly being taken on, not taken over, but taken on by the rest of the world. So we have to work very hard to make sure that democratic principles prevail. China is a country that doesn't want democratic principles in its new networks. We have to make sure that there's fairness and legality as far as economics is concerned. We have to make sure that cultural things, all the misuses which are in the internet now for human trafficking and all that, that has to stop. Or it has to at least, it won't stop, but it has to be at least, there has to be ways of trying to control it. And this is, as I said, what I'm talking about here is everything's going to be different. The European Union as it exists today won't exist in 10 years. It'll be something different. It will exist. It will be better than it is now, but it won't exist. It'll be much more multi-centric. Chancellor Merkel is, in fact, Chancellor Merkel keeps saying two things which are very interesting for Germany. One is that the European Union is moving from a commission-based thing to a community-based thing. If you talk to my retired ambassador friends from Germany, they say that's the worst thing that can happen. We can't trust having Germany free in a political situation in Europe. Well, yes, we can trust Germany to be free. You don't need the commission to keep you under control anymore. But secondly, and this is the most difficult in a way, and I heard the chancellor say this herself just about a month ago. Secondly, the way this world is developing, Europe only has one world-class economy, and that's Germany. And she said at the opening of the CeBIT in Hanover, she said, the problem is that we're a world-class economy. She said something I never thought I'd heard a German chancellor say, and everybody else is Mittelmaß. That's really something. But she said it, I swear to you, you can look it up. Look it up in Google.
That's what you call humility.
This is a challenge which is right now going to make Germany less flexible and more unbending, more, if you will, authoritarian with its partners. And that's why, as Carsten says, in Southern Europe right now, you are the America of Europe because everybody thinks they're being pushed around by you. Are there better ways to do it? I think there probably are. I think Germany should, you know, as we say, chill out a little bit on this, but I'm not sure they will, because for Germany, there is one major sanction, and that is losing one's global economic role. And that's something which Germany can simply not even believe that could happen. So again, it's just going to be very, very difficult in years to come, but it's going to be very exciting also.
I think on one side, you need a reform of the existing international institutions. I'm not so sure whether the time is ripe to build new ones. Therefore, in this foreseeable future, we will have ad hoc coalitions and ad hoc groupings like the Friends of Afghanistan, those who met this weekend to discuss the Greek crisis, which was a core group inside the European Union, not foreseen in any of the statutes, and those contact groups, which you have uncertain. And then you might legitimize it by the UN, by an EU decision, by a NATO decision. And I would also could foresee a couple of problems where the Russians would be in on equal level when we discuss Iran, when we discuss Afghanistan. On other issues like North Korea, China is there on an equal level. So you have to look, first of all, you have to look how you solve concrete problems and how you include in the solution those whom you need for the solution. And then how you integrate this into a larger process of a political debate and legitimation by existing international institutions which are reformed. But I think it would be wrong first to invent new institutions and then to look how they might solve existing problems. And there we Germans have a tendency to do the latter and to avoid the former. And that, I think, has to do with a situation in which in Germany has to discover its role, as you rightly said. By the way, in economic field, Germans do it, as you could see this weekend, exactly this weekend. In the political field, we are not used to it. And I think this, and there what we need is not only that German politicians handle this in a different way. I think what we also need is we should be honest about our role. We need a debate between us and the German population. And the German population is not on the side of reality yet. They like those who prefer Switzerland. And this is, I think, something which you can see in public opinion polls, when you see in which direction people vote. It's always in direction of the soft answer. Soft answers are always very popular. The problem is only that they are nice, but not always sufficient. And therefore, to make decisions between sometimes tough alternatives is something that Germans don't like. And if it's necessary to make these decisions, they don't want to be part of them. And if they can't avoid to be part of them, they at least want to be on the moral high ground and be skeptical about the behavior of others. And this is not sufficient.
Good. We're going to have to wrap it up there. Mr. Kornblum, thank you very much for a very interesting discussion that was anything but Mittelmaß. And I think we've learned from Mr. Kornblum that Americans have to learn that it's okay to be managers on the global scale. And the Germans, we've learned from Mr. Vogt, the Germans need to learn that it's okay to be the nice, strong guy, and it's okay not to be Swiss. Thank you very much, gentlemen.